loads of seats at the front. People at the back, they can't hear me. They might not just come to the front. Or not. I've got about 45 minutes to talk. I'm going to talk about obviously what I've been doing here, but also about what I've been doing the last 20 years. But so I'll log you everything because it's the older you get, the more you get to show. So I'll try and be brief. But I think I might start with this diagram. It's a very important work for me because it's to do with a project that actually was premiered in Liverpool in 1997, and it's called Acid Brass, and it's a brass band playing acid house music. And the diagram really is the explanation of it. It's what makes it art as opposed to just a music project, in the sense that it's my thoughts about what it would be like for a brass band to play acid house music and why that would be interesting as an art project. And it's the explanation of it really, and where it shows how my mind works and how my interest in music, politics, and social history, and landscapes are all combined, really. Especially in terms of the way that music in Britain is part of history, it's part of our history, and can tell a story. So this diagram is in itself telling a story, really, about Britain, and about why these two music movements that on the face of it have nothing in common actually do have quite a lot in common, in the sense of... Should we turn the lights down? In the sense that they meet, they're from different centuries effectively, but it's telling the story of Britain from going from an industrial culture to a post-industrial culture. And the connection of them is through politics, is through civil unrest and the media hysteria and so on, mainly based around the miners' strike, as you can see on the diagram. I don't even have to point to it. For me, I did this because I remember when the miners went back to work in 85, they often went back to work in a colliery band or pit band at the Hague. They would process back into work, like basically processing back into no work, because a lot of pits have been closed within 2 or 3 years. So it's a very, very strong image for me as a child, as a young person. So this diagram really was in my mind very quickly when I had the idea for a band to play with the music. And of course, a lot of it has to do with what was going on at the time, that media hysteria. But really, without that diagram, I don't consider it an artwork. What's important though was that before I was working with the band, I'd been trying to make art in a more traditional sense. I've been trying to sort of make objects and have exhibitions. And some have been more successful than others, but when I worked with the band, I realised that actually this is what I wanted to do. I wanted to work like this, I wanted to work with people. And in a sense, the band liberated me from trying to fit myself into what the notion of an artist was, a gallery artist. So I'm very grateful to them for saying yes to this. This is them playing at Love Box in London. It's a big dance music festival. And what's exciting, and what's really exciting for me about this, was the fact that the band was full of young people, but they would play to audiences who were in their 60s, 70s, 80s. So the first time I saw the band do a traditional gig, as I would call it, they were actually, there's a woman in the front row doing a knitting as the band. But when they play concerts like this, they're playing to people their own age. They were treated, especially at this concert, as sort of like total rock stars. And so that was, for me, sort of very exciting, going on that adventure with them, basically. And it was an adventure. So that's 97 and onwards, and the band played music every year, they do gigs and so on. And I'm in contact with them, but I just let them get on with it. There's no point in me managing and trying to micromanage the concerts they did. On a sort of less fun note, from that diagram you saw the miners' strike and war greed, two things that really obsessed me as a child, as a young person growing up in Britain. There's a whole year of news about the strike, and it's something that I witnessed on TV, I witnessed through the media, I wasn't anywhere near it. So it didn't affect me at all in the sense of my day-to-day life. I lived in South London, I was at a private school. 2 years above me at the school was Nigel Farage, so I mean, I was in a kind of strange environment, not particularly sympathetic one to this either, I have to say. when I look at him, Farage, and I think about what my school was like, he's an absolute product of the school I was at. He's a total product, he hasn't grown up at all in a way. So the strike was a really big deal for me, something I really observed, and was disturbed me. And I thought that it was always in my mind to revisit the battle that I'd seen on TV, the Battle of Albury. And it's always something that I was very interested in researching just for myself. And so I got an opportunity to make a reenactment of it. It was an open call from Art Angel, and as was the Acid Brass. So my two biggest breaks really have come through some almost anonymous sort of commissions, because no one really knew I was for both of these things. But I was commissioned to do them, I was very lucky with it. And I wrote an idea down to do the reenactment, you know, it's three sentences, and they said yes. And I was almost calling their bluff. Kind of smart work you do. You never expect to make them, you're basically pressurising people to make them, or like I said, calling their bluff just to see if they'll take the bait, and they did, and we did it. So it's another image from the strike. This would be obviously in the summer months. Quite an interesting photograph, you see what's going on around, just like a history painting, the guy's been whacked to the front, people sort of smiling and running, and but this would be some picket, I imagine, with a maybe a scab going in or a broken line. Anyway, so I got to make the reenactment, and that was a 3-year research project, really, which became more and more intense in, you know, the final weeks and the event itself. I was virtually powerless with these things happening, and really, whatever I wanted, it didn't matter if it was going to happen and people were going to do it. And I sort of lost control of the project, which was fine, really. What I really wanted to do, though, with this reenactment was to return to the scene of crime, effectively, and to examine a crime scene with a reenactment. And the way that police will reenact crimes or reenact an event that they can't work out, like a child, like, you know, murders and so on, and just to jog the public memory. And that's basically what I was doing. I was remaking a crime scene. It was a public event. And it was, which is very important, the public can witness it. And it wasn't meant to be cathartic. You know, we know so much of this work, when you work with communities, you work with people, subtext or even the text, is that you're there to make the world a better place, you're there to make people happy or to heal wounds, all those sorts of things. I wasn't interested in that in the slightest. I mean, people were still very angry about the strike in these places. Some people have come to terms with it, but others definitely have not. So I was quite interested in that. I wasn't there to make people feel better about the world. And especially with the audience, I wanted them to actually feel quite bad about what happened. So that was something that was very important. So it was like a post-mortem. It was almost like digging up a corpse and poking around it. Remember, this was 2001, it was in June, and it was the sort of height of New Labour, really, before the war in Iraq. And in a sense, it was I was trying to go against Paul Britannia, I felt. I was very happy to be doing that. Paul Britannia, the whole London art scene, the sort of Elton, as I call it. Not like anything about against Elton John at all, but it was like an Elton Johnization of the London art world, as I would call it. And I just wanted to go to do something, probably the least glamorous subject ever, like trade union politics and the miners' strike, and make a work about that in the face of the sort of amnesia really about the strike, but it was never part of the political discourse at that point. It's like it never happened. And certainly the local council were not very happy with it happening, but they couldn't do anything to stop it. So this is another image of the reenactment. What's interesting is that reenactors are obsessed with history, and reenactment is, and battle reenactment is often, when you see it, it's really obsessed with the minutiae of history, and with the tactics and with the guns and the technology and so on, but they're never really that interested in the sort of social aspects and the sort of consequences of the battle and what life was actually like for those people and why the war was being fought. All those things that, you know, about power basically, are of little interest in them. So I wanted to do a reenactment with people, and I should say the people that took part in the reenactment were former miners who'd been in the strike. They were their families, but also with battle reenactors. Because I actually wanted I was almost as interested in the world of Battle Royale Anthem as I was in the world of the Miner's Strike and the consequence of the Miner's Strike, because it's such a, their view of history is so strange in a way. And I wanted to bring them up to the present, more or less, and reenact the battle that A, was in living memory, and B, no one was killed in the battle, but it's gone into the sort of canon of great battles, if you can call it that, in British history. So I really wanted them to be involved in a political reenactment, even though a lot of reenactors are quite conservative, if not right-wing. So their idea of who the miners were, they still saw the miners as the enemy within, effectively. And so, you know, the documentary at the time, there's a lot of tension between the reenactors and the miners. But the tension really comes from the reenactors' sort of self-reinforcing belief that the miners were dangerous people and still were dangerous people. So there's a lot of tension between them, which actually made the reenactment incredibly realistic. So yes, it was very much about the world of reenactment, about bringing it up to date, effectively. And also just thinking about what history is, and also, you know, what history, how we view our history in Britain. I gave a talk recently in Germany, and I said, well, if you came to Britain and turned on the TV any night of the week, you'd think that World War II is still going on, or just only just finished, because of the way we were obsessed with the war. And so I was interested in that, about how, you know, the great battles that have been fought on British soil, and just bringing it up to the present moment. So that, in a way, these are the two key works that I'm known for, certainly up to this point. In a way, the Miners' Strike was about how Britain was going to change, how would it change from being an industrial society to a post-industrial society, and what would happen, how would we do that? Did we do it with care and love, or did we do it with violence and with basically contempt? And so that change in Britain, for me, is the big story, one of the big stories of post-war Britain. And this photograph sort of sums it up in a way. And it's strangely very, very related to the Battle of Albury and that work. And, it's a photograph of Adrian Street, the wrestler, the glam rock wrestler, with his father at Pit Head in Bryn Mawr in Wales. Adrian was a miner. Adrian's on the right, by the way, in case you didn't know. he was a miner, and he left the pit at 16, went to London to find fame and fortune, and eventually, it's a very interesting life story. He was a bodybuilder and glamour model for bodybuilding. Basically, he didn't realise he was a gay pinup. For years, he didn't realise what was going on, doing this sort of posing and so on. And then he became a wrestler, and sort of took his vengeance on Wales and the world through his violence as a sort of wrestler. He hated Wales, hated his father, hated the culture of the pit, and so came back to Wales, to the pit he'd been in, to show these people what he'd made of his life. That's what the picture is, it's a piece of revenge. But also, it's basically showing these men what the future of Britain was going to be like. It wasn't going to be mines, it was going to be TV, it was going to be the entertainment industry, the service industry. So in a way, he's quite a prophetic character. Strangely for me, you can see this picture, you just think of lots of Renaissance portraits, you can think, you know, as I studied art history, when I go to art college, you know, it's like a history painting. But really, for me, it's like this. It's like some kind of Blakean image. It's like, if you think of Jerusalem, the poem, that's a poem about Christ coming to Britain during the Industrial Revolution and trying to work out what to make of it, what would happen if Christ came to Britain, what would he think of us. And in a sense, Adrian is in a similar position. He's coming from the future, effectively, to show the past, what the future will be like. I made a film with him. I won't show any clips now, because we're sort of up against the time a little bit, but I made a film, and what's brilliant about someone like Adrian, who's like an incredible narcissist, by his own admission, is that he's just documented his life from the age of like 15 onwards. So there's just hundreds of photographs of him. This is him probably just getting to London, doing bodybuilding and sort of showing off his skills. I might actually be in Wales when I said that. Yeah, his persona became more and more outrageous and grotesque. because at the age of 40 he had to move to America because wrestling was taken off the telly. So he had to reinvent himself again in America as a wrestler. He's a tiny guy, he's my height, if not maybe even shorter, and fighting these sort of giants in America. So he's incredibly, his willpower is just insane. And until about 3 years ago, he was still wrestling at the age of 70. And he effectively made his whole life this sort of artwork, and was as a continuous performance to be documented every day. So he's, this is someone, like I said, who in a sense encapsulated sort of acid brass and the Battle of Albury, this turn from industry to post-industry, and he embodied it literally. So that's an obsession. We will get to Epstein, I promise you, but I'm just going through some other things to do with music, basically. I was very interested, in the Industrial Revolution. I wasn't really taught at school, but then I realised that I wanted to make a show about the Industrial Revolution, how it is now, really, what the legacy of it was. So I did a show based around, very loosely around music and culture and the Industrial Revolution. Traditional exhibition, basically. So on the left there's a painting by John Martin, Solomon Gomorrah from Newcastle City Art Gallery. Martin just painted these amazing cities collapsing in on themselves as apocalyptic scenes. And basically he's painting the Victorian city, even though they're meant to be Old Testament stories. Because at the same time as he's doing this, he's trying to invent ways of getting the sewage out of cities. He's trying to invent ways of getting gas out of mines. So he's very aware of the potential for disaster in industry and in the cities. On the right, am I trying to do something really cleverly? Oh, there you go. You know, he has these epic images. This is a fulfillment centre, Amazon fulfillment centre in Rugeley. Again, it's, you know, the Industrial Revolution, you see a lot of imagery of mills. There's very glamorous places, these amazing vistas, people working incredibly, people incredibly proud of them. It was a sort of propaganda image, basically, of the mills, but they looked like these incredible places. I mean, you would have been deafened going into one, but with the perspective to go forever. And then I saw this image in the Financial Times, I do a piece about Amazon, working for Amazon. I just thought, well, this is basically like the equivalent of a mill, and we all know this. But I just thought it was interesting having it around images of mills. This is a device that you wear, and it's probably have different devices now. This is about 4 years ago. If you work for Amazon or any of these big retailers, in these big sheds, and it's the device that goes, it's the stock checking device, and it's the device that tells you where to go to pick up objects, and then the thing on the thumb is a scanner. The barcode scanner. But not only does it tell you where to go, but it also will tell you if you're not working for quickly enough, and it'll start giving you reminders and sort of turn you off basically. You can program to do that. So it's a sort of weird bionic instrument that you work to wear. In the mill, you would have someone going around with a big stick telling you to work hard or not to do this or that, but now obviously you wear that thing. That's a very small slide, as you can tell. It's almost actual size, it's of an album cover. And it's of the Judas Priest Breaking the Law album. It might even be a live album. And what I was interested in also was this idea of rock music and heavy metal, and about why it was so. We know, you know, it's almost like a BBC 4 documentary, I'm going to be laying down, talk about sort of sounds and factories affecting music being made and, you know, drop hammer. I know it's almost a cliche to speak like this, but I think it's actually true because it's spoken by so many people. And weirdly, even Iggy Pop speaks of these things and how it affected him and how he made that very, very tough rock music in the late 60s because of where he was living, you know, near Detroit. So, if you think about heavy metal, it's basically a sort of glamorized, ritualistic version of what heavy industry is. If you have a heavy metal concert, you have lots of smoke, you have lights, you have noises that are based on industry. You have men who are super macho doing these things and sort of working hard on tours and just showing that they're real workers. And it was almost, for me, it was almost like a requiem for industry, heavy metal. And especially when you think that it was so popular in Britain, you know, its heyday was probably the late 70s, early 80s in Britain, when these bands were just like massive. And that was just at the moment when these industries were closing. So all the young men who would go to see these concerts, all these 14, 15 year old boys, who were basically the real heavy metal fans, boys their age, were going to see this version of what industrial life would be like. But they were going to be actually cut out from that. For probably the first time in 100 years, there was no guarantee they'd go on to work in a factory. So they'd go to a concert and actually get this version of factory life, almost, or heavy, interesting industrial life. So in the exhibition, we had a. Player, it's a jukebox, and on it we had just sounds of factories from around Britain. Often recorded by these amazing sound archives, which of course have since closed in the last 5 or 10 years, that would go around and like record factories for the last time. And so you have all these amazing sounds from around Britain. The North West Sound Archive was one. An incredible place. Really amazing. And so you here, it was just a jukebox, but it would just be the sounds from factories all over Britain. And making a very plain point. This is, would be, I think, very interesting to one here. This is the also a way of showing about change in Britain through industry, but just also to show the connection between rock music and industry, or music industry. I did a series of family trees, and this is Molly Holder's family tree. Might need a bit of explaining to some of the young people. Nobby Holder was the singer of Slade, a very special band for me. And I also did the family tree of Sean Ryder and Brian Ferry. And both, all three of them, almost exclusively, were born in a place where most of their family, for like 200 years, were also born in a 20-mile radius. And almost exclusively, again, had jobs in industry, the industry of that place. So very solid background. I'll just show you some things. We talk about classic sort of Midlands, Birmingham industries here. You see these sort of workshop industries like Springwood Maker, Tom Filer, Lock Maker, Bridal Stitcher. There's a lot of leather work that goes on in Birmingham and also Chainmaker. So like absolutely classic pedigree Noddy has. As you'd expect from him. So in a way that's a very explicit connection between rock and history. Brian Ferry, weirdly, I met Noddy Goldman and showed him this, he was fascinated by it. I've never seen it before, I've never seen his family tree. Brian Ferry was less happy with it. For some reason he wasn't. It's very well known that his father was a miner, which I have to pick moments in a bit. But for some reason, he was not very happy with the rest of his history being seen. Another part of the show was these sort of industrial, basically industrial folk songs that were made and then sold in the streets. So in a way, you know, folk music's the songs that are handed down. These are songs that actually make people money. So I don't know, but you could argue it's the beginning of the music industry, basically in publishing. To make songs very cheaply and mass produce them. In a way, the 7-inch singles would be mass produced, people buy them cheaply. These are similar things before recording music. And a lot of them are about life in cities, cautionary tales. You know, as well as traditional songs about wooing, winning, there were songs about the young man coming to Manchester, meeting a young woman, going back to her house or saying she would look after him, and then realizing she's a prostitute. So, all these sort of cautionary tales, and this is a very famous one. This is about lunchtime. I think lunch, dinner, it's not clear, I suppose, but this is about lunchtime in, or dinner time in Oldham Street. Oldham Street. There's others about, great ones about Manchester on a Saturday night, what it's like, you know, lots of drinking, fighting, and all that kind of stuff. So they're really great songs, very funny. There's an amazing one called The Life in 1973, which was written in 1873, and it's about what the world would be like in 100 years. There's no church, there's no law, food is abundant, people flying everywhere. I mean, they get like 10% right, 50% right, even though they probably never expected to do that. There's nothing about the internet, at least, but it's very interesting. Yeah. So these are great songs, and those are in the exhibition as well. Going on to, I already mentioned Iggy Pop, but I thought I would bring this into the talk before I talk about Brian Epstein. 10 years ago, I wrote to him, or more even now, and said, I've had an idea to do a show about him. I'm a big fan of Mike Kelly, some of you might know his work, artists from Detroit. And I saw Mike Kelly's show, and I just thought, God, I would love to make something that was just so 100%, 110% Mike Kelly. What would it be? And I just thought, it has to be mixing fine art with popular culture. And Iggy Pop is a huge influence on Mike Kelly, so I just thought, it has to be some sort of something to do with life class, life drawing, Iggy Pop. And so I thought that actually could happen. I could see this happening. I could see the drawings, I could see the class and how you do it. The whole thing was sort of complete, like that diagram at the beginning. Everything sort of fell into place. It's like, okay, that's what it would be like. But getting those ideas, for me personally, you don't get that many of them, but you're lucky that you can get them. And so I had that idea. 10 years ago, I wrote to him, and he said, no, I can't do it. I'm sorry, but I like the idea. And then someone said to me a couple of years ago, you should write to him again. And I did, and he wrote the long email back to me under someone else's name, his assistant's name, because he doesn't really use the internet. I think he dictated it. I couldn't work out who was right to me, because I couldn't work it out. I thought, this guy's insane, this is a strange thing to me. And then at the end, he signed it, and I realised he'd said yes, so we would do it. And he said he wanted to do it because he didn't want to do it 10 years ago because he was too young to pose naked again. He wanted to actually get older before he did it. And also he said that, you know, his career wasn't where it could be. He was just rebuilding his career as he felt that's where he was. And he didn't want to distract that part of his career with this project. And it might get sort of folded into other things. Mm-hmm. You want it to be a discrete, separate project. So that's a very good way of describing it. I'm very glad that's what you thought. And of course, you know, some of us here, I don't have to describe or tell you why this person is important, why that his body is such an amazing thing, it's such an incredible object. And so I think probably post-war America is the most important male body, maybe his and Muhammad Ali. What it says about culture and how it became synonymous with something. So he agreed, and of course I was thinking of all these images about his body, about how he's used his body, what it's seen, what it's witnessed, what's been into it, what's come out of it, where it's been. All those things, you know, it basically has witnessed his life. And also it's very unusual almost unique for a man to basically appear topless for nearly 50 years. Nearly 50 years continuously be topless on stage. And so we've been able to chart his aging very clearly. It's been absolutely there for us. And I think that's really almost unique in culture. I can't think of many other people have done it so consistently as him. He's also been willing to sort of hurt himself and use his body and abuse his body. So this is something that I felt had legs. And also, because I wasn't really interested, it had to be him. It couldn't be any other person. You know, people say, well, why don't you just do this person or that person? But actually, no, his body speaks so much, it has so much inscribed on it. And then I thought about our history and about the male body and about the worship of the male body and the uses of the male body, the sacred and the profane. But the man nude was these things together, which of course is that tension between sacred and profane is really the tension with rock music. How rock music came out of churches, particularly black churches in the South. And it's that tension that gave it the forbidden element to it. And also a lot of those early stars were very conflicted about that. So that's what I wanted. Iggy Pop had posed a lot, naked a lot, or quite a lot, in the late 60s when he went to New York for the first time. He was telling me he wanted to sort of make his mark in New York, and he thought the way to do it was to take his clothes off, basically, and do nude sessions for people. And so what he liked, the idea, was that he was coming back to New York almost 50 years later to be naked again, but at the other end of his career, effectively. Or as he called it, the other end of the rainbow. And so there he is in the class. It looks very posed, doesn't it? Because everyone's sort of really intent, working intent, not posed. But, well, he's posed, clearly. But this is the class. It's a four-hour class. It's done with lots of different students from all different backgrounds. The way I did it was basically I spent a week in New York looking at different life classes or student-sponsored life classes and selecting what I felt was a selection of images of him. And this one's just a picture. You took a picture of the back, of that image. You haven't done anything with it, have you? Have you done anything with it? Could you not send it? I'll tell you why. Because that image is an image, actually, that he doesn't want people to see. But I'm showing it to you. If you saw that someone posted it, I'd be in deep shit. So just give it to memory, but don't take a picture of it. Because it's actually not there to be seen. Anyway, back to the class. People from all over the New York area, all ages, as you'll see, there's a picture of the class in a sec. So I want to have like almost a representative of America drawing. There he is. Drawing himself. Yeah, he was very excited to be in. You know, it's a 4-hour process of being still. And of course, that's the absurdity within it is, of course, that he's never still. He's never still on stage. And because of that, you don't actually get to see what his body's really like, because it's always in movement and he's travelling around. And you can't. Even with photographs, you don't get that idea. But it's still a photograph of the body moving. And so, in a way, drawing is really the only way to properly describe him and his body. And I felt that was really important. Anyway, that's the class with me, the curator. And like I said, I wanted to really have Americans looking at America. I thought it was very important. Also, all the drawings were then automatically given to a museum. So there was no exchange of financial. These drawings won't turn up at auction houses or galleries. They will absolutely be owned by the American people, effectively. As I see it, even though museums in America don't quite work like they do in Britain. So there he is, enjoying himself. I'll show you some of the drawings now. We did four poses, I think it was four. One long pose, three very short ones, maybe four short ones. Just really, I wanted to get the short ones in. This is the long pose. Just because I was worried I'd get bored and walk off, and just had some drawings. It just wasn't clear. I just couldn't believe he was doing it. That was clear. It's a long pose. You know, they're not the most flattering things either. For most of us, we sat down and we wouldn't necessarily be happy with what we've got. But he was very brave in a sense, allowing himself to be scrutinized like this. So many different styles. This young woman had been drawing for 2 weeks. Just 2 weeks. She sort of nailed it in a way. She nailed his sort of body, the way that people didn't. You might not know this, but he has one leg shorter than the other. And so he has this very awkward standing gait. He has a gait that's sort of twisted. And I felt these drawings, to me, looked like they'd been done in Germany in the 1920s by Eric Heckel, Kirsch, or something like that. They're very expressionistic, very quickly made. And, that's an exaggeration, but it's not that exaggerated about how he stands. And he loved these, as did I, because they're quite odd and they're quite visceral interpretations of him. And this is a performance artist whose name is totally escaped me. The guy who shot himself.
Chris Burton.
Just going back to Iggy, the idea of hurt yourself and the performance art, I just thought he was really like a performance artist as well. And the life class was a form of performance by him. But he definitely played into, was doing this similar sort of ritualistic, self-harming performances that were going on in California at the time, all around America. And whether he knew about them or not, I had no idea. Whether he knew about him or not, I had no idea. But there's definitely a relationship between these two art forms. Anyway, going back to the drawings. Yes, yeah, so the drawings displayed, it was very important to show them in a very normal way, not to have any crazy rock and roll interpretation, just have the drawings as you'd expect to see them if you went to the British Museum, Princeton Drawings Room, or anything like that. Nice frames, mounts, with the name of the artist underneath. Just because I wanted them to be seen as very traditional. It's a very traditional exhibition, really, from an idea that comes from a non-traditional angle, I suppose. Alongside all that, this is in the Brooklyn Museum, finishes next week, but also it's coming to Britain early next year. Exhibition. Alongside that, we took items from the Brooklyn Museum collection. It's one of these encyclopedic museums, it's great museums in America, or in Britain as well. All to do with male nudity. So we had a Robert May before. We had paintings from drawings from Germany in the 1920s, nudes. We have many things, but a lot of the stuff we had was anonymous work from Africa, from India, Buddhas, naked Buddhas, naked figures from Africa, and also Greek and Roman sculpture. This is a tiny little setting. So this is an object of devotion from Rome, a Roman object of devotion. And these satyrs basically had would go out rampaging, getting drunk, finding women, and they had these oversized sort of cocks, and they make music as well. And he was playing harp with the cock. It's fabulous. And I just thought that was a very apt sort of thought of using the rock music and thinking ancient cultures. So actually, we're not very shy about these kinds of things. We're a lot more shy. But also, again, this sort of tension between the sacred and the profane. So these objects were in the middle of the room, all the drawings were around the side. Anyway, this is the last section. I'm just going to talk very briefly about this project. This is Brian Epstein, probably with his mother, who was called Queenie because she was, her accent was so cut glass, and there's actually recordings of her speaking online you can hear, and it's just the most amazing accent. That's him and his mum. I don't know what it is, where they are. But I've sort of been interested in Epstein for a long time. His dad now as well. Interested in them because of his role in the band did not exist as it did without him. You know, the world would be a very different place without him, I think. And I don't think he's ever really been given the credit, Matt, really, for what he achieved. And so I've always been interested in him as a character and his contribution to popular music, popular culture. And some years ago I came up with the phrase Brian Epstein died for you, which has of course within it has potential to offend people on slightly different levels, which I was aware of. But for me it's a sincere belief, you know, if you think of rock music and popular culture as a religion in a sense, as a belief system, then he has a role within that, he has a kind of martyr role within that. And so he had a huge belief in the band, and he was in a way a sort of prophetic figure, seeing in them what no one else saw, and steering into this huge success. But at the same time, he was a deeply unhappy person, for a number of reasons, not least his sexuality, So he was someone at, really at the centre of the world for 3 or 4 years. Wherever he was, if he was with the band, he was in the most exciting place in the world, you could argue. And yet he was a very lonely person as well. So I felt he made some sort of sacrifice for himself, for the band, and for this thing we know now as sort of popular music or rock music. So it's such an important thing within that. So that's where the phrase comes from. That's the image we've used in the end. And it's a phrase I've sort of toyed with and played with before and done little things with, but never on the scale that I was allowed to here. So I was asked to think of something to do with the song Little Help from My Friends, which is a very bittersweet song. It's quite a melancholic, sad song. It was sung really out of key. It's a very funny song as well, a lot of wordplay in it. But it's you never really know. When he says a little help, it means like no help, or just a little bit of help, because they are helping me, or they're not helping me at all, my friends. And so I thought that was interesting, because Epstein was really one of the few friends the Beatles had, one of the few people they could trust, or they had a inner cohort of maybe 4 or 5 people, and he's one of them. And so he was their best friend, effectively, and I think it was a mutual love that they had for each other. So it's definitely the work for me is a very sincere thing, and it's definitely something that I believe as well. You know, you can talk about. I'm of the age, as you can tell, if you see all the work I've made, but popular music and rock music as well for me is a very important thing, and it's, you know, I grew up with it, and it became almost a sort of near religious thing for me. So we. My idea, very simply, there's 2 ideas with this project. One was to just take that phrase and take it back to Liverpool. I've never really used it in Liverpool, but also have it in a sense of a production that I'd never be able to do otherwise. Have it on these major, major sites around the town, and then also fly post it. So this is in the station. It doesn't look really, does it? It's like photoshops. That's the thing about it. That's because it's lit from the back, so it has this kind of quite otherworldly quality to it. And just have the phrase all around the town, intervening really. I thought it was really interesting and important to have it fly posted, because then it would be around other posters that would refer to the culture that we helped to create, effectively, and helped to nurture, and almost invented. So it kind of goes home, in effect, not only to Liverpool, but it goes amongst other posters of people enjoying music or musical events and bands and so on. I also wanted to do it in Hebrew for a number of reasons. 2, in a sense, you know, that phrase, "Brian Epstein died for you," a lot of people don't know who he is, so they wouldn't even know what that meant. A lot of people who knew who he is, who know who he is, don't believe it, think it's stupid. But the people who know, the believers, as I would call them, would get it. And even if they don't totally believe it, because it's a strange conceit, they would understand it. They would understand the sacrifice of what he did for us, effectively. So it's in its own right, the poster in English is a code, and it's a sort of rhythm almost. Then I thought I should put it into Hebrew, which makes it even more mysterious. Also, it refers to him as a Jewish, young Jewish man in Liverpool, and his family were observant, and he's buried in the Jewish cemetery. This is great, some years ago. So it's referring to that, to his heritage. So we have that. We have these images of him. Some people really love underneath that. And then it's big. Again, this doesn't look really, because it's on Erskine Street. His face just massive. And I think, just this is today. And I love those posters outside churches, the ones that have bits of scripture on that say things, Christ died for sins, or other posts of the Bible. I actually really quite like those unapologetic religious quotations of them. So it's like that in a sense, it's unapologetic. And the great thing about posters is, as opposed to the internet, is that
people really see them in the real world. They don't just see them on the screen. They see them in a context of a living world. And that's very important, I think, to do that, to put things out there. Because I could have just made that into a nice little thing and just post it online and we looked and shared. But to the shock of seeing that, again, this doesn't look real either. This intervention, this kind of graphic intervention in the city, I think is what's important. This is something I did 2 weeks ago, 2.5 weeks ago. And just going on about the idea of posters being important and just thinking analog rather than digital a lot of the time. Because if you do something that people like that's analog, it will become digital. And so that's important. And so hence this was something I did. Almost in the style of the Epstein posters, I was asked at very short notice to come up with something for the election. And I just did this really stupid thing on the computer. I mean, it's kind of pathetic in a way. I mean, it's like childish. But it resonated. Probably because the phrase itself was so childish and patronising. But you could only treat it with contempt. And which is what I did, basically. So, again, something in the street, in a context, it's a black and white in a colour world, I think it's so important. And it really stands out when you do that. So, again, they're sort of related, both of them related. This is the last slide. We're doing all right for time. We'll do some questions after this. So that's a horrible thing now, which is my I feel like I've got some awful skin disease. I don't know, it's just like biting my fingernails. Like, So, as well as doing this big public project, the posters are up for 2 weeks.
I think it's estimated to be seen by about 600,000 people, or something ridiculous like that. Forgive me, it's
4.5 million.
4.5 million. See, that wasn't even exaggerating. I was downplaying.
Yes, but 4.5 million views in the real world. And then I stuck online, which is fantastic. And I just thought, well, I can't just do that because it's sort of an old idea in a way. I want to do something else about friendship and helping people. And so I came up with the idea that for one day, if you did a call out, you got a call out from a builder for an emergency, you know, plumbing, or you got locked out, or you had some work to do in your house, it would be free. You wouldn't know it until at the end where you'd be expecting to write a check or do whatever to pay, and you'd actually be given a little card. This is like a plastic credit card, which just says today you're up, well, you read it. And it was a little act of sort of almost necessarily kindness, but just helping someone in an unexpected way. And they're very private. How many did we do in the
27.
And we didn't document them heavily, we just had a few photographs. It wasn't like a film crew there with three and someone's name. So, because if you documented it, then people would realise something was up. Photographer turns up with a plumber. It's not really. Anyway. So, that was the sort of private thing, private performance basically that was going on in the city at the same time as the posters were up. I reckon that's more or less.
There's
some other things to show, but I think I can leave it at that and just answer questions, if that's alright.
Yeah, we've got some time for questions, then we go through for food. So, is there anyone who has any questions for Jeremy about any of the work?
Yes.
I'm just wondering, with your mind map, for example,
yeah.
Is this the sort of thing you do ahead of creating artwork, or can you only do it with hindsight, or is it a mixture? Or?
That's a good question. Did you hear it?
Yeah.
Well, I don't really do many things like that. In a notebook, I just write words and maybe a view arrow, but that mind map basically occurred to me fully when I had the idea. It was like, bang, all right, it's all this, that's what it is. But I don't do many of those things, but that came almost simultaneous to the idea, which is unusual, but it's like, you know, it's almost like a vision or a flash or something like, bang, that's it. And often, with ideas like that, big, what I would call kind of big ideas in a sense, they're very simple but big. The idea comes whole, as it were, and you can almost visualise it in the future, 2 years, 3 years in the future. So the thing I did with the soldiers in the streets, I don't know if you know about that thing I did for the First World War, the idea I had for that more or less was the same as, the end result was more or less the same as the idea itself. So, I can't remember what the question was, but yes, they're simultaneous. That's this idea, basically. This is my visualisation of it 3 years ago. What could it look like? People in the street commemorating the sun. And I had this idea that this is how it would be. Anyway, I'll go back to that without fun. There we go.
That's the meaning. But yeah, it's definitely diagrams like that all the time.
Yeah.
Fascinating before you said that Bath of Orgrave, and you said I kind of lost control once the event started to happen.
Yes.
It took on its own life.
Yeah.
Obviously quite a lot of your works, once it kind of starts to begin to when it begins to happen, it's out of your control in a way. What position do you consider yourself when that happens? Are you still the artist, or are you?
I'm a terrified onlooker. With Aubrey, though, it's interesting. The first half was on a field, and it was quite stagey, and I wasn't that happy with it. So I just walked away from it and went and bought a Mars bar or something, and then came back and it was finished, and I was just glad it finished because there's nothing I could do to change it. And watching it was so stressful. So stressful that I just let it happen. And you just got to trust people. But also, I really trusted the miners then, the former miners, because they totally understood it instinctively what I was trying to do. But in those roles, I'm sort of a kind of director, but not in control. But that was a unique thing. There's not many examples of that. But, with the soldiers, the song, they had very strict scripts to adhere to. So we kind of knew what to do. Really good. But with reenactment of a riot, which is a contradiction in itself, you really don't know what's going to happen. And if things go wrong, it's actually for the better than that. In the second half, the timings were out because everyone had these earpieces, a lot of people did, and they got all the timings wrong, so things happened that weren't meant to, but actually made it a lot more exciting. So, accidents are good. Yeah, not seriously, in the sense that things by happening by accident or seeing something and breathing in correctly.
How far ahead of your mind in terms of work are you? Because it's so idea based. You're having a constant, you have a library of ideas.
I wish I did have a library of ideas. It's a very small library at the moment. The Iggy Pop thing I wait over 10 years for, but there's things that are just floating about. Like everyone, we all have ideas, don't we? And it's just some things happen much quicker than others, but at the moment I don't have a big project on the go. It's actually relatively quiet.
So you don't know in 2 years' time you've got no idea where you might be?
No, I don't know where I'll be in 2 years' time. And I'm very lucky anyway, because I'm always getting people asking me to meet and for me to do stuff, so I'm very, very lucky. It's one that doesn't bother me, but doesn't worry me. Yes.
How about like shorter term? Because you obviously did the strong and stable posters.
That was so good.
Shorter term, you obviously did the strong and stable posters before the election.
Mm-hmm.
Now that that's happened, do you think you could see yourself producing a response to how that landscape looks going forward?
Possibly. I mean, it's very interesting, isn't it? What's happening? I mean, not interesting. It's horrible things that have been going on. Fire in the Tower Rock. All those things. Things happening very quickly in Britain at the moment, much quicker than anyone thought. And that could almost turn into it's going to be a major scandal. But I wouldn't react to that necessarily, but I think at the moment things are changing in a way that I've not seen for decades. But yeah, you're always keeping. I did a poster, for example, for a magazine that just said blue is the new orange. No, orange is the new blue, which is about orange men and the Conservative Party. So there's funny little things like that. I mean, that poster really is just such a stupid, simple idea, but those often work quite well. So you're always on the lookout for that and an opportunity to do something that isn't just an internet thing, basically.
Did you put them all in? There was a first floor and it was full of those posters all along?
I didn't personally do it.
Yeah.
But someone did it.
Yeah.
Yeah, obviously. But they were sent out to fly poster people all over Britain to put up. And they made smaller ones that you could buy and stuff. And just sort of, and then people did their own versions, which is fine. You've got, people made their own ones and so on. But I was surprised how it took off. But that's because there was something, there was a need for it without anyone realising it. Just have to put it like that. It was in the air. Everyone wants curry. Oh, maybe it's not the last question.
I've already asked one, so
yeah.
You talked about, or briefly mentioned, mistakes and accidents sometimes being very important.
Yeah.
Could you, do you have examples you could share? I don't know if that's an easy question.
Examples of accidents. I can't, but I probably will in about half an hour, I can tell you about curry. But it's often when you mishear something, or you misread something, or you see something and you think it's just something else. And then you realise that actually it wasn't that, but that would be a good thing if something said this rather than that. I'm not very clear, but I think there's a lot of times when you're making a film and you edit something incorrectly, that's much better. You put a piece of music you weren't expecting under something, and then you realise actually that's perfect. So it's those sorts of things. Chance, I suppose, is it.
Any final questions for Jeremy before we go through? No? Okay. Well, if everyone could just join me in thanking Jeremy, stick around.